right, so you're probably like cramming for your con law final, or maybe you're just like one of those people who really loves digging into like the big cases, you know, the ones that really like changed how rights actually work out there in the world.
The ones that make a real impact.
Exactly. Well, get ready because today's deep dive is it's all about Singleton v. Wolf.
Oh yeah, Singleton. That's a good one.
It's a 1976 Supreme Court case, and it tackles a big one. Can you sue for someone else's rights?
Even if you're not the one who's like directly hurt by whatever's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the whole idea of third-party standing, right?
Right. And Singleton is like the case that everyone points to figure that out.
Yeah, you see Singleton cited all the time still. It's a landmark case.
So let's set the scene. Okay, so we're in Missouri, 1976, and we've got these two doctors.
And they are not happy.
Not happy at all. They're furious about this state law that says Medicaid will only pay for abortions if the mother's life is in danger.
Yeah, they're saying it's unconstitutional, bad medicine, you name it.
And what's really interesting here is that the doctors weren't just like worried about their patients, you know, although I'm sure they were.
Oh, absolutely. They cared about their patients.
But they were also saying, hey, this law is hurting our practice too.
Right. Because if they can't get reimbursed by Medicaid for those procedures, it's a financial hit for them.
Yeah. Hits them right in the wallet.
But the lower courts were like, hold on, docs. This law doesn't directly harm you, so you don't have standing to sue.
Yeah. So it's like a classic third party standing problem. Can these doctors really go to court for their patients' rights?
The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals thought so.
They did?
Yeah, they overturned the lower court's decision.
Interesting.
And then, bam, up it goes to the Supreme Court.
High drama. So what do the Supremes have to say about all this?
Well, in a 5-4 decision, the court sided with the doctors. They said, yep, these docs actually do have standing to sue.
Wow. Okay, so the court agreed with the Eighth Circuit.
On that part, yeah, Justice Blackmun, he wrote the majority opinion, and his reasoning is like, it's really important because it kind of set the stage for how we think about this whole third-party standing thing, even today.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Then why did Blackmun think these doctors were the right people to bring this case?
So he argued that the doctors were being harmed, like actually harmed. Remember, they were losing money because they couldn't get Medicaid to pay for these abortions.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like a direct financial hit because of this law.
Exactly. But Blackmun went deeper than just the money.
Okay, so it wasn't just about them losing money.
No, he pointed out that the doctor-patient relationship, it's unique. There's this built-in trust. You know, doctors have an ethical duty to look out for their patients.
Right, and especially with something like pregnancy. You know, it's so sensitive and things can change so fast.
Exactly. Blackmun was saying that doctors are often the best people to fight for their patients' rights in these situations.
Because patients might not want to sue themselves.
Right? There's privacy concerns, the fear of stigma, plus the pregnancy might end before the case is even over.
And then the whole case is moot, right?
Exactly. So Blackmun's saying the doctors, they weren't just some random people butting in.
They were directly affected by the law, and they were the best ones to fight for their patients.
That's the key point. It's not just about the doctors having some interest in the case. It's that specific combo of harm and that doctor-patient bond.
Interesting. So that's what makes Singleton so important. It's not just about abortion. It sets this example of when someone else can step up and fight for someone's rights.
Exactly. It's about who has the power to speak up for others in court.
Okay, so the Supreme Court said the doctors had standing case closed, right?
Well, not quite. There's another twist here. The Supreme Court actually, they had some things to say to the Eighth Circuit, even though they agreed about the standing issue.
Oh, court drama. What'd the Eighth Circuit do?
Well, remember how the Eighth Circuit overturned the lower court on standing?
Uh-huh.
They didn't just stop there. They went ahead and ruled on the Missouri law itself.
Oh, so they said the law was unconstitutional?
Yeah, they said it violated the Equal Protection Clause.
So they kind of jumped the gun and decided the whole case without giving Missouri a chance to defend its law.
Pretty much.
Seems unfair.
The Supreme Court thought so, too. They were basically like, hey, Eighth Circuit, you're an appeals court. Your job's to review what the lower court did, not, like, decide the whole case.
So they were out of line procedurally.
Yeah. The Supreme Court was like, look, you got the standing part right, but send it back down to the lower courts for a real trial.
Interesting. So even when the answer seems obvious, you got to follow the rules?
Exactly. It's about the process.
Okay. So we got a 5-4 decision for the doctors, but it wasn't a complete slam dunk.
Not at all. There were these concurring and dissenting opinions that, like, add another layer to all
this. Let's dig into those.
All right, let's do it.
Concurrences and dissents always spice things up.
They're where the real action is. Sometimes, you know, you see the justices really hashing out their ideas.
All right, so next up, we're going to tackle those concurring and dissenting opinions in Singleton v. Wolf.
It's going to get good. Buckle up.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Okay, so we're back, and we're talking about those concurring and dissenting opinions in Singleton v. Wolf.
Right, because even though the court decided the doctors could sue, it wasn't like everyone agreed on why. You know.
Exactly. There were some different takes on how far this whole third-party standing thing should go.
So Justice Stevens, he wrote a concurring opinion. What was his take?
He agreed with the outcome. you know, that the doctors could sue, but he was a little more hesitant about, like, expanding third-party standing too broadly.
So he was okay with it in this specific case, but not like a free-for-all?
Right. He focused on the fact that the Dodgers were being harmed themselves. Remember, they were losing money because of this law.
Yeah, that's right.
So Stevens was more comfortable saying, look, the doctors have standing because they're being hurt, rather than focusing on their ability to represent their patients.
So he wasn't completely on board with this idea of just anyone suing on behalf of someone else?
Exactly. He was a little more cautious about opening those floodgates.
Makes sense. What about the dissent?
Justice Powell, he was not happy. He wrote this dissenting opinion saying that the majority had gone way too far.
So he thought third-party standing was a bad idea altogether.
Pretty much, he was worried it would, like, water down the whole idea of standing, you know, making it too easy for people to sue when they weren't really harmed themselves.
Oh, I see. So he's thinking about all those frivolous lawsuits.
Exactly. He thought people should only be able to sue if they have a real personal stake in the outcome of the case, not just some general interest in the issue.
That makes sense. You don't want the courts clogged up with lawsuits from people who are just trying to stir the pot.
Right. But here's where it gets even more interesting. Singleton didn't just decide this one case about abortion in Missouri. It actually set up a two-part test that courts still use today to figure out if someone can sue on behalf of someone else.
Okay, a two-part test, spill the tea. What are the magic ingredients for third-party standing, according to Singleton?
All right, so first, the relationship between the person suing and the person whose rights they're fighting for, it has to be super close.
Like best friends forever close.
Basically, the court called it inextricably bound.
Okay, so not just anyone can waltz in and say, "I'm suing on behalf of all the oppressed pizza delivery drivers in America."
Right, there needs to be a strong connection, like the doctor-patient relationship.
Gotcha. And what's the second part of the test?
The second part is that the person whose rights are actually being violated, they have to have a real reason why they can't sue themselves.
So it can't be like, "Oh, I just don't feel like going to court, so you do it for me."
Right, there needs to be a legitimate obstacle, like maybe they're afraid of what will happen if they sue, or the case would be over before it even got to court.
I see. So like if the person is in hiding or something.
Exactly. Those two things, the close relationship and the real barrier to suing those, are like the cornerstones of the Singleton test.
And this test has been used in a lot of different cases, right?
Oh yeah, tons. Especially in areas like reproductive rights where, you know, patients often have a hard time suing on their own.
Okay, so give me an example of how this has played out in the real world.
Okay, so think about Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt. That was a huge Supreme Court case back in 2016.
Oh yeah, I remember that one.
So in that case, abortion providers in Texas, they used Singleton to challenge these really restrictive state regulations. They were saying that these rules would force clinics to close, which would make it way harder for their patients to get abortions.
So they were basically saying, "We're standing up for our patients who are going to be hurt by these laws."
Exactly. And the Supreme Court, they actually cited Singleton and said, yeah, these providers have standing to sue.
Wow, so they agreed that the providers were close enough to their patients and that the patients had real obstacles to bringing their own lawsuits.
Exactly. That's the power of Singleton. It's from like 1976, but it's still shaping these big legal battles about abortion almost 50 years later.
Crazy. So Singleton's a pretty big deal.
It's a landmark decision. It's given a voice to people who might not have been able to speak up for themselves in court.
That's a good thing, right?
Well, it can be, but like any powerful tool to have to be careful how you use it.
What do you mean?
Well, there are some ethical questions about third-party standing. You know, it's not just about the legal stuff.
Okay, so what are some of the potential problems?
Well, on the one hand, it seems like a good thing to let people fight for those who can't fight for themselves, right?
Yeah, that seems fair.
But where do you draw the line? Like, who decides when someone needs to be rescued with a lawsuit?
So it's kind of tricky, right? Like, it seems like a good thing to help people who can't fight for themselves, but like...
But who gets to make that call, right? Does someone actually want to be saved with a lawsuit?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what if they don't agree with how the lawsuit is going or what it's trying to do?
It can be kind of paternalistic, you know? Like, we know better than you.
Yeah, like, let me handle this little guy.
And then there's the whole issue of conflicts of interest.
Oh yeah, good point. Like the person bringing the lawsuit, they might have good intentions, but they also have their own reasons for doing it.
Exactly. Like think about those environmental cases we were talking about. A group might sue to stop a development project, right?
Saying it's bad for the environment and the people who live there?
Right. But some of those people might actually want the project. You know, they need the jobs.
So then who are you really fighting for?
It gets complicated, right? That's why you got to be really open and honest when you're doing a third-party standing case. The person suing has to be clear about what they're trying to do and make sure it really lines up with what the people they're supposed to be representing actually want.
So it's not just about winning the case, it's about doing the right thing.
Exactly. You don't want to just force your own ideas on someone else.
That's a good point. So where does all this leave us with third-party standing? Is Singleton going to be around forever, or are people going to start pushing back against it?
It's hard to say for sure, but I think we'll see a little bit of both. You know, third-party standing is really important for a lot of social justice movements and advocacy groups.
Because there are always going to be people who can't go to court on their own.
Right, and Singleton gives them a way to do that, even with all the challenges.
But you're also saying we might see more people questioning these cases, more pushback from those who are worried about people taking advantage of the system.
Definitely. I think the courts are going to be more careful about who they let sue on behalf of someone else. They're going to want to make sure it's really legitimate.
So it's like a balancing act. You have to make sure people can get justice, but also make sure no one is being taken advantage of.
Exactly. And that's what makes this era of law so interesting. You're not just dealing with these abstract legal ideas, you're dealing with real people and real problems.
So what's the big takeaway for our listeners?
Singleton is a huge case. It's changed how we think about access to justice and who gets to speak for who in court. It's given us this powerful tool for advocacy, but it also comes with some serious ethical questions.
And those questions aren't going away anytime soon.
Nope. So if you're a lawyer or a law student and you're dealing with third-party standing, remember, it's not just about checking off boxes on a test. It's about thinking about the real people involved and making sure justice is done.
Great advice. So whether you're studying for finals or arguing a case in court, keep those minds sharp and those legal arguments even sharper. We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.